So yesterday we had a good conversation with Samkem Hlongo, as we always do on Minding Your Money. And one of the issues that came up was the question of black tax. Some people called in, one listener in particular, called in to dispute that term at all. We got messages, people spoke about guilt, they spoke about mental stress, and they spoke about the difficulties of talking these issues through with your family. We're going to get some expert advice on that in a moment, but just to set the scene, let's hear from just two of the listeners who joined yesterday's conversation.
I think the black tax issue affects many of us, and with me, it's still an ongoing issue. So I come from a middle-class average family, and then unfortunately, one of my parents got into a business. It didn't go well. Around about 2012 or 2013, the financial constraints really, really kicked in. I had to get two part-time jobs while doing my honors, and things didn't get better, to be quite honest. So I really share the sentiments of most of the callers, and you need a therapist, you need a life coach, and you need a financial advisor.
Okay, so that was one point of view, one story, and let's hear another.
I myself was the only person to be able to go to varsity, and I've got three siblings. My mom passed on recently. Each time when I get paid, that guilt that you're referring to, it's always coming through. So when I get paid, I know the day before I'm going to get messages, you know, asking what it is that they need. It's important. It's depressing, and it could be suicidal.
Yeah, so lots and lots of strong feelings, not just about the money, but about the relationships that come into play when the money is discussed. So let's welcome our guest now. Joining me in the studio here at 702 is clinical psychologist Sikanda Kala, who is the founder of Cohesive Collaboration. Mr. Kala, welcome, and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, John. You're most welcome.
Is this a topic that comes up in the course of your work? And if so, what kind of issues come to play?
Most certainly. And I'm so glad that you touched on that. It's a relational matter as well. And it's got an emotional and psychological component, because often we think about it in a limited financial context, because that's where the most acute and obvious expectation is. But how it affects relationships, and not only interpersonal relationships, but one's relationship with themselves internally. You know, you touched on the theme of guilt. And, you know, it's not only guilt, but there's a whole range of emotions, you know, that extends to shame, which is felt more from a societal perspective.
Right.
And also at the same time, disillusionment and being burdened with the overwhelmment of it. So it really is quite a layered theme. And I do see it coming up in a lot of the work that I do. And not only clinically, but even anecdotally. I come from a Pedi background myself, half Pedi, and I've also felt some of those dynamics flare up as well. So it really transcends in multiple domains.
One of the things that's very striking, I mean, I think the issue of guilt is has played out over centuries and continues to do so across communities. After all I've done for you, you treat me like this, you speak to me this way, you never call me, all those kinds of things. But somehow when there's a sense that this is tied to a set of financial obligations, that appears to me to be much more constraining, because in a sense it's measurable. My late mother might have said to me, you very seldom call me, but she didn't ever or often say to me, well, you were meant to do this thing for me or your younger brother, and you never did. This seems to me to be an acute and quite specific pressure.
That's spot on. I think when you add a quantifiable metric to it, it makes it so much more defined in what the expectation is, and that creates a deeper sense of responsibility and obligation. And interestingly enough, you know, I was talking about a range of emotions, but I think this is also where the theme of resentment kicks in as well.
Yes, yes.
Because often what ends up happening is the sense of expectation and obligation does not match up to what is actually feasible or sustainable. And once there's that mismatch between the feasibility and the sustainability, essentially what it feels like to the individual is you don't care about how this affects me and how it impacts me. You don't have that empathy, that consideration, that compassion. And that's why it starts feeling like a very dehumanizing experience.
So we're going to go to traffic now, but then we're going to come back to this conversation. Sikanda Kale is a clinical psychologist, founder of Cohesive Collaboration. And we are talking about some of the issues that came up yesterday when we talked about black tax. Maybe you've got an issue that's troubling you, or maybe you've dealt with it in a way that you'd love to share with other people because it actually worked and resolved some of the extraordinary complexity of this issue. So you know our number, 011-883-0702. It's a rich conversation. It's an important one. Why don't you join in? 011-883-0702, 16 past four. The emotional issues that surround black tax. Join our conversation. I'm with Sikhanda Kala, who is the founder of Cohesive Collaboration and a clinical psychologist. Mr. Kala, is one of the thorny things about this that in many ways, let's just say there are two parties, although invariably this is a multilateral relationship, that they're both right? That the person who says, you know what, I need to live my own life and get on with things is right, but they're not exclusively right, because the people who say, hey, we put in before, this is how you are able to live your own life. That must be quite a hard thing to unravel, certainly in the work you do.
Indeed. And I think that's where the guilt emanates from, because the guilt is layered in some form of, there is something that justifies me feeling some sense of
guilt.
Yes. And I think that only emanates from the perspective when there's an internal conflict as to, maybe I should be doing something. Maybe I should be fulfilling a certain expectation. Maybe I should be paying my dues. But I think you touch on a very important point, which is often this is like a unilateral conversation where it's someone speaking at someone rather than speaking with someone.
Yeah.
And that's where the lack of context and information is really prevalent. And once there's a lack of that information, we immediately go back into falling into that trap of finding some sense of disconnect between I'm struggling to fulfill this expectation versus my expectation feels legitimate to me.
I was thinking while you were speaking there that an additional complication, and we can layer this thing probably for another hour, but I want to put this to you. Isn't it made more difficult by the fact that so much of this is a conversation about pain? And I don't necessarily mean pain with a capital P and block capitals for the other letters, but these are painful stories about families managing to finally get somewhere against all the obstacles with the wind in their teeth. And it must be very hard to, I'm not sure, what's your approach, for example? Do you say, can we step back from that and talk about the now? That must be a very difficult approach, and I don't even know if it would work.
Yeah, I think what's so essential about that is pulling back the sort of sentiment of villainizing one another.
Yes, yes.
Because if you listen to the stories that we had at the start, it's all rooted in some adversity that has prompted this. There's structural and systemic factors. I think about the pandemic as well, that really wiped people out from a financial and job security perspective. So you can imagine families that had an identified breadwinner that was maybe the elder in the family, but a pandemic comes and wipes that out entirely. And now we're looking to individuals that have some form of job security or financial security. So it always feels quite legitimate to the individual that's requiring those sort of expectations.
Yes.
But I think one big gap is we're struggling to have the open conversations that are multivariate and also multilateral in a sense, where you're hearing all the voices, that it's not elder to child and it's not dependent and it's not rooted in some form of villainization of I need this and I'm being unreasonable to you. So I think that's, if we start having those conversations and we normalize having those conversations, we can really lay the context flat out, and then people can start having a conversation about what is reasonable, what is feasible, what is sustainable.
Yeah, I must admit, every time you talk, I come up with another four questions. For example, the fact that this is all on a moving timeline, and that the gap between a six-year-old and a 25-year-old parent is very, very different when the parent's 44 and the child is now 25. We'll get to that in a moment. But here's a very important question, and I'd like your thoughts. Afternoon, John, just a question for your guest while one is dealing with black tax. How much more of a strain can it put in a marriage where the one partner is dealing with this issue, black tax, while the other isn't? And is it something that you've experienced in the work that you do? Important, because in a sense, we're talking about historical relationships, but people are forming new ones all the time, partnerships, marriages, and more.
Definitely. I think that it's, you know, when you enter into a relationship, it's three entities. It's you, it's your partner, and it's the relational unit.
Yes.
And when you're suffering obligations or expectations or responsibilities, that affects the relational unit as well. And it's so interesting, because you were mentioning also an age component to it, but if we think about gender dynamics, that adds a whole nother layer as well. You know, if you think about the sort of hegemonic masculinity expectation in South Africa, where the man is the breadwinner or the provider or what have you, it then creates also those sort of expectations that feel not only gendered, but gendered within a relational context as well. And one looks for leadership and one looks for guidance in the relational space. But when there are all these extenuating factors and confounding variables, it just makes things so much messy.
You spoke about the pandemic, and the other thing that became constrained was space, because people who might have been living their own life, living alone, maybe had to either move in with a family or back to a family or take family members in. And I would imagine that the claustrophobia that everybody felt in COVID must have made that a lot worse. Do you find that most people, Mr. Culler, try to resolve this by saying, you know what, I'm out of here? Which, of course, means that you don't quite resolve it. You just move it into a box, sort of extra space storage kind of arrangement. Or are you experiencing, presumably with the help of you and your colleagues, that there are routes and maybe even methodologies where people can start saying, let's unravel this and let's do it carefully, but with an end goal in mind?
Indeed. I think the proclivity to avoid, repress and suppress things is always prevalent. As human beings, I think we rather run away from conflictual dynamics than confront them head on. So it most certainly is the case. But then you have a different sort of guilt and disappointment that begins to emerge, which is, I've let go of my family. Yes. In a sense, I've had to let people go. And that's the thing. It's often in life, it's not all bad. You know, there's the good with the bad.
Yes.
So there may be expectations, there may be responsibilities that are being thrown your way, but you still love your family. You still want to be there. You still want to have that sort of familial interaction. And I think when you choose the path of letting go or just running away from the issue, you then have to grieve the loss of the good aspects of your loved ones. And that's heartbreaking in its own unique way. With regard to, are there ways in which it can be approached? Most
yes.
certainly. You know, I think effective communication is where it begins. And I think conversations like this, where we normalize speaking about issues like this, it results in people realizing that they're not alone in the process, and we share our narratives, we share our experiences, and then we start devising game plans for it as well. And it also helps to avoid suffering in silence, which is a pandemic in itself as well.
Yes.
Which, you know, one of the users mentioned suicide. And we often see that suffering in silence is a slippery slope that leads to depression and suicide and all other sort of manifestations.
What I often wonder with people who are in the mental health healing space is, who heals the healer? Mm. Because I'm sure at the end of the day, your head's pretty full. But you mentioned that you've dealt with this yourself. I mean, do you know, as much detail or as little as you would like, but do you find the fact that you've had that direct experience has helped you in specific ways with this conversation?
I definitely think experientially going through something creates some level of increased empathy and understanding for all the nuances of it, because we spoke about it being layered, but more than it being layered, it's also nuanced.
Yes.
And those subtleties manifest differently for each person. So if you can get a better grasp of those subtleties, you have a platform to work with, and then you start unpacking it. So I most certainly agree with that. And I would also say, on some level, the sentiment of how do we navigate through it, I think, needs to be a gross process of unlearning and relearning. And that comes when it comes to communication. Like, how do we start having open conversations that break down the layers
yeah.
and unpack it in a way that everyone understands what's going on?
All while living incredibly busy and pressurized lives. But we got one of our listeners wants to share something. Let's hear it.
Hi, John and your listeners. I think my earliest memory of Black Text was that of my supervisor at that time complaining that at home they never ever call him. He was working out of the province. They never bothered to find out how he was. Even if there was a disaster in Johannesburg, nobody would ever pick up the call and phone to say, how are you? Are you well? But each time he's going to get paid. Definitely he will get that phone call, and it would be very demanding, and sometimes even in the middle of the month. So the resentment starts there, where people are just expecting things from you. And he said he doesn't feel like he's part of the family, but just their ATM and always looking for provision instead of being seen as a child of a family. Luckily, I haven't had to go through that, but it does affect a lot of people, the way, the approach, I guess, around it.
So, Sikanda Kala, while you were hearing that, you were nodding. Perhaps a thought on that and a final thought.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the earlier point we touched on about the dehumanizing component to it. And, you know, even if you think of objectification, it's almost objectification as you're the ATM that just needs to provide. And that's why I said it goes into a space of resentment because there's such a lack of compassion and empathy. And tying in with a concluding sentiment, what I would say is often we don't want to have these sort of discussions because we feel like the more transparent and revealing we are of the income, the larger the expectations be. But maybe to acquaint the individuals with the expenses rather than the income and to say, hey, this is all the responsibilities that I already have. Me and my partner and our children. These are all of the responsibilities that we have. And that's why it makes things very difficult to navigate through this. Hence why I said one of the biggest aspects of the effective communication is the boundary setting. If you can give that transparency when it comes to what your constraints are, you can then start negotiating what the boundaries are. And once you negotiate the boundaries effectively, you can say in principle, this is what we've agreed on and this is the most I can stretch myself.